Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Henrik Ibsen's play A Doll's House is one of the most produced works worldwide, even though it was first staged 140 years ago. Is the play and the protagonist Nora Heller still relevant today? Our guest Wendy Swallow thinks so. She's written a sequel to A Doll's House titled Searching for Nora After The Doll's House. Welcome.
Thank you.
So give us a quick synopsis of the play A Doll's House for people who aren't familiar with it.
So the play A Doll's House is about a fairly young bourgeois mother and wife in Norway in the late 1880s who has a little problem going on. There's a legal problem at the heart of the play, and she's committed a small crime which she's keeping as a secret from her husband. And during the course of the play, she's being blackmailed about that. And the secret ultimately comes out, and she and her husband, Torvald, have a fierce conversation / argument. And at the end of it, she realizes she can't stay married to him anymore because of the horrible things he said to her. And she walks away. Mm. And the play ends with her slamming the door. And theater people call it the slam heard round the world because it's one of the first salvos in the feminist war.
Yeah. So the play was controversial when it was first staged. Tell us why.
It was extremely controversial. It was the talk of all of Europe, and mostly because Nora leaves behind her three children. Now, in that day and time, people would have understood that her husband had full legal responsibility for the children, that she really didn't, because she had no right to property or money, she could not be expected to care for them. But still, it shocked everyone.
Mm. So did the play resonate with you the first time you read it or saw it? You know, or did something, did it come back to you when you went through your own divorce?
Yes, I first read the play and saw it when I was in college, and I was immediately struck by Nora's character because she's a multifaceted, sort of confounding figure. She goes through a transformation in the course of the play, which is Ibsen's genius, really. She changes quite a bit from Act 1 to Act 3, which is sort of a revealing, but it's... She's a character that never left my mind. I always thought about her and wondered, where did this transformation ultimately take her?
That's really good writing, that it could stay with you. A character could stay with you that long, right?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, Ibsen, she's also one of the first truly real women in drama, in European drama, and she just leaps off the stage.
So in addition to Searching for Nora, you've written two memoirs, one about your divorce and the other about your remarriage. What compelled you to shift gears and write fiction, and why did you zero in on Nora?
Well,
a lot of questions there.
Like many, so I was a newspaper reporter and then taught journalism, and during that period I wrote my two memoirs, which are technically nonfiction, well, are nonfiction, mm-hmm. But I, of course, had always harbored the dream of writing a novel. I had written one in college as a challenge for my father, and I had written short stories, and I always wanted to get back to fiction. So I finally realized I sort of had the time and space after the boys went off to college themselves that I could do that. And when I started thinking about it, the story that had been with me for so long, and my divorce really brought Nora back to me. I saw the play just as I was separating from my first husband with two small children. And I suddenly realized as she's walking out the door and slamming it in that production I saw back then, I realized this is going to be so much harder. It's hard enough for me to do this, but look at her. She has almost no rights. She has no access to her children necessarily, and she has no one to support her. Mm. So what is going to happen to her? And I had thought about that for years. So when I sat down to write a novel, that was the one in my head.
So interesting that you had thought about her for years, and then here you find yourself in somewhat, not a completely similar situation, but, right. But I mean, that you can really feel for her character now even more than when you weren't a mother and going through this situation yourself.
That's true. The leaving the children part, I sense that, to be honest, I thought the only thing Ibsen maybe didn't fully understand was how hard it would be for her, mm-hmm. to leave her children. And he has her do it with more ease than I think is probably... would be accurate for most women. So when I divorced, I had to share custody of my two boys with my first husband. And even though I saw them half of every week, it was still a very painful experience for me.
So to give listeners a sense of Nora and how she left at the end of Ibsen's play, would you read an early passage from your book?
Sure. This is at the very beginning. My book starts with Nora on the other side of the door that she has just slammed. And it's the middle of the night. It is the day after Christmas. And we're in Christiania, Norway, which is the city now known as Oslo. So it's quite cold. So she says, "I left late one frigid night. Torvald, too stunned to stop me, stood gaping in the parlor as I clattered down the apartment stairs and slammed the big front door. I wanted to shake the gossips from their beds, to send them to the window to glimpse the unthinkable Nora Helmer walking away in her traveling coat with a satchel. I did it to leave Torvald in a stew of scandalous talk because it was what he feared most, more than he feared losing me. Outside, the cold knocked the air from my lungs. I grabbed the railing to steady myself and hesitated for a long moment, suspended between two worlds. Inside, the lamp still flickered, and all that had been my world shimmered in the firelight, the chairs pulled up beside the stove, my embroidery hoop waiting on the footstool, my darling children asleep in the nursery. It would be so easy to slip back in and say I was sorry, to beg his forgiveness, to sink back into the suffocating eiderdown of my life. But I was not sorry. Sorry would come later, pulling me down like grass in a mountain lake, but not now. Instead, a surge of exhilaration swept up from my feet. I was free, as if all the constraints and rules of my marriage had fallen away with the slamming of the door. I was just Nora, no longer Torvald's squirrel, no longer his wife. I took a deep breath, then plunged into the icy street. My boots skidded on the frozen ruts, so I hurried as best I could, skirting the gas lights and sucking in the electric air. Afraid that Torvald might come after me, I ducked down an alley, stumbling past ash cans in the knee-deep snow. I took other alleys and soon lost my way, but it didn't matter. I only needed to disappear. I walked and walked, slipping past stately houses and darkened apartment buildings. I barely felt the weight of my bag, as I had taken so little, just a few clothes, my lotions, my pearls. But there were other burdens. Everything that had happened spun through my mind. Torvald's words, in particular, cut like fragments of glass. How had it come to this fevered flight? I knew, and I didn't know. It happened at the sad end of Christmas. The overwrought children were finally asleep, and Torvald and I, limp with brandy, had lingered in the drawing room. And then he found the letter, delivered earlier, the letter from my blackmailer. The letter that said I forged my dead father's signature for the loan. When he understood what I'd done, he shouted and called up my father's flimsy values, saying he should have known I would be no better. He didn't care that I'd done it to save his life. Hypocrite and liar, he called me, his accusing finger shaking with anger, furious I had acted behind his back. Then when he thought he was ruined, criminal, disgusting, shameful, and the final wound, that he would never trust me with the children again. And so our marriage cracked open, and the life I'd known spilled away. The cold finally caught up with me. I stopped, lost in a jumble of weathered cottages, and slumped against a wall to breathe. And as I did, my circumstances settled gently on my shoulders, like snow. I had left home to wander the city alone at night, and I had left my children behind. I thought of them sleeping in their rumpled beds, Ivar with his long legs sticking out from the sheets, Bobby curled like a forest creature, Emma snuffling in her crib. She had a cold. Would nurse summon the doctor tomorrow? She could sicken and die, and I might never know. I couldn't bear the thought of that, so I stamped my feet to make sure they weren't frozen and looked about. In the distance, I could see the warehouses along the harbor. After everything that had happened, I had come down to the fjord after all. I walked toward the water. The big port was unusually quiet, emptied by the holiday. Darkened ships lined the bulkhead and stacks of lumber loomed in the shadows. Snatches of fiddle music echoed across the bay from the drinking houses of Vika, the slum on the other side. Life went on, apparently, but so far away it didn't seem to include me anymore. Instead, there was the sea, the beckoning sea. As I stepped out on the dock, the thick cold of the fjord reached for me like ghostly arms. Maybe this was how it should be. Throughout this awful Christmas, as my black mailer circled in, there seemed to be just one way out, down into this dark water. At the farthest end, I inched my toes out over the last plank. This would be Torvald's punishment, then, for all of it, marrying me, belittling me, accusing me. But it would also be a gift, as I would take my shame with me into the depths. I gazed south down the fjord. The deeper water was quiet and forgiving, heaving gently under the crystalline sky. I could solve it all with one small step, no more than stepping off the stoop outside our apartment. I wouldn't have to crawl home to my aunt or beg for work. The children would grieve, yes, but in time they would recover and go on with their lives. And Torvald? His honor would be restored, but at night guilt would come to climb into bed to lie with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you really bring us back to the time. And as you're saying, you know, women who didn't have a lot of rights then. And I can see how she would linger in your mind and you know, think, you know, what would happen to her? Yes. And interesting that, you know, you talk about Ibsen and not really maybe understanding how difficult it was for her to leave the children behind. So maybe it needed this woman's perspective.
Oh, boy, that's an interesting question. I do think that as a woman, there are many aspects of Nora that are resonant. But Nora is a very flawed character. She mm-hmm. has her challenges. She is given to lying and manipulating and masquerading, hiding her authority and power. But as a woman, I actually always recognize myself in Nora. So,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so she's flawed. Like all of us, we have some flaws. She isn't honest with her husband. She makes excuses to herself and others about her dishonesty. So what are her motives and which of her flaws did you find most challenging to write around?
That's an interesting question. Her motives are that she has so little authority in her world. It's a very patriarchal system. The laws are designed, written by men and designed for men, as those are Ibsen's own words. He was aware of that, which is part of why he's writing this story.
And true of the time.
And very true of the times. So she has no way of grasping the levers of power in her marriage unless she manipulates, unless she deceives and hides. But I will tell you that her lying, which is her way of hiding who she really is, and that's, Ibsen's very interested in the tension between realism and idealism, sort of how people like to think they are, but how they really are. And so much of my book is about her coming to terms with who she really is and finding her way to a place where she can stand honestly before the world and doesn't need to hide who she is anymore and to give up her lying. And I'll tell you, the lying was the hardest thing to write around. And some readers say to me, "Oh my goodness, I couldn't believe it. She told another lie." And I said, "Well, yes, because she's not ready yet to give it up." So,
yeah. And I would think that would be a challenge too, because, you know, if you aren't someone who lies, right, it's hard to kind of get into that mindset of why and how difficult it is to be a liar, because you have to remember all the lies, right?
Yes. Although I will say that she is on a journey. And so she is in shifting groups as she goes. And that is part of her effort to masquerade, is to move again.
Yeah. We're talking with Wendy Swallow. Her book is Searching for Nora, a novel after The Doll's House. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Wendy Swallow. She's written a sequel to Henrik Ibsen's play, A Doll's House. It's titled Searching for Nora, After the Doll's House. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So how is Nora in your novel different from Nora that we're introduced to in Ibsen's play, and what aspects of her character did you not want to change?
Some of the things I did not want to change is that she's very pragmatic. She's a survivor. She will do what she needs to do to protect her family and find a solution to problems that present themselves. She's also very adaptable, and I thought I could really work with that. The way she's different is that the purpose of my novel and the reason I wrote a novel, not something shorter like a sequel play, is I really wanted to see her grow up and develop and emerge as her best self, and that I knew that was going to take time and experiences that would strip her down so that she really had to face who she was. Mm. And so I would say that by the end of my novel, she is a very different woman in the way she interacts with the world, but she's still this sort of intrepid, adaptable survivor.
Mm. In your novel, Nora immigrates to Minnesota. Why?
It was very bleak out there. And at one point when I was doing the research for the story, immigration historian in Norway suggested I send her to Chicago. And he said, yeah, Chicago was really hot back then. There was this big Norwegian community that would be so exciting for her. But I thought that was a cool idea, but I also realized that wasn't going to work with what I was trying to do with Nora herself. And Chicago would have been too easy. She's an urban girl anyway. I wanted to send her to the prairie where she doesn't even know how to milk a cow. She doesn't know how to help. She doesn't know how to be useful. And she has to figure that out. It sort of takes her back to a more primitive time. At the same time, though, women are very valued in that environment because you know, family didn't make it if everyone didn't work. And so her contribution in that environment would be valued. And that's one of the things she feels she doesn't have in her bourgeois life of the parlor back in Christiania, that she's pretty much useless except for knitting.
Hmm. So your book has two storylines, one about Nora, a second about a young female university student. Solvi, is that how we say
yes,
it?
Solvi.
Tell us more about Solvi and what brings her to the story.
So Solvi's story is set in 1919 at the end of World War I, and she is part of that generation of young women who begin to take the freedoms that they're starting to wrest control of, and she would like to live them out in a way that makes her very different from her mother, who content to sort of stay at home and just raise a child. And Solvi and her friend Rika, the pair of them, are a way of looking at Nora's generation, which is two generations earlier, through the prism of that sort of halfway stage in women's rights when they had just gotten the vote. They're beginning to break out, that young women like Solvi are beginning to want to have a career, to work. They don't use the word career. They mm-hmm. say things like, well, we want to contribute. We want to matter in the world. And Solvi and her friend Rika are women who are young women who are determined to actually get out there.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about the research. Obviously, it took a little bit of research. Did you purposely want to make this historically accurate?
Yes. And when I started working on this book, I realized that I wanted to keep Nora's story in the 1880s because that is Ibsen's time. That's the time he's talking about. And if you move the story up into the 20th century, it loses much of its danger and risk and power. So what Nora does is extremely radical, and by leaving her husband, very risky, and one of the most singular acts of independence in literature. And if you move the story into the 20th century, it loses that. So I felt very strongly that I wanted to keep it in Ibsen's time. So I read a lot about Ibsen. I read much of the scholarship about Dahl's House. And then I did a lot of work on Norwegian history, both in Nora's time and then in Solvi's time in the early 1920s.
And where they would have immigrated to and where these communities would
yes.
be and all
yes.
of that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So what was the most surprising thing you unearthed in your research? There's always surprises.
The biggest surprise to me was I did not understand about the Norwegian diaspora to the New World, mostly the U.S., but also Canada. Between 1825 and 1925, a third of the population of Norway left. Most of them were men. There were families, young mothers with small children, but predominantly men, younger men, laborers, people, so, you know, farmers. And it was very destabilizing to Norway, of course, socially and economically. What's interesting, though, is when we got to Norway, my husband and I went there to do research on the book, I for the first time understood this strong link the Norwegians feel to America, because there are so many people of Norwegian descent in the U.S. Who still feel very strongly about their Norwegian ancestry. And there was a lot of back and forth between the two countries as well, a lot of exchange of ideas and funds. And they were in Norway. The whole American experience is very integrated into their knowledge base.
So did your views of the playwright Henrik Ibsen and his work change as a result of your research? Did you look at him any differently once you had looked into all of that?
Well, I'd always thought he was, you know, obviously a giant of modern drama. That's obvious. But what's interesting about Ibsen to me is that here he was, this Victorian figure, this man, and somehow he understands what women are going through. And then he has the courage to write about it. And in the face of a lot of protest, he was pressured to change the end of the play so Nora wouldn't leave. He was, in fact, he was told he had to write an alternative, and he did. And then a week later, he tore it up. He said, I'm sorry, the play is the play, and that's what I meant to do. So he was very much affected by his wife and her family. She came from a very sort of free-thinking family of that time, and she had female relatives of various sorts that had varying fates, all of which hinged on how well they married or if they married. And Ibsen was struck by that, by the trap that marriage could be, by the requirement of marriage and how much it defined women's lives. And he was troubled by that.
Yeah. And really, when you think about it, very brave for him to stick with his ending, right? I mean, because he had no idea what the future would hold as far as the popularity of this play over all these years. But
exactly. Yeah. In fact, a famous actress in Europe, I can't remember her name now, not well known now, but very famous at the time, refused to play Nora unless he changed the ending. And so the producer said, okay, you have to rewrite the ending. And he wrote an ending where instead of leaving, Nora goes down the hall to say goodbye to the children, peeks into the nursery, can't do it, crumples to the ground, and that's the end of the play. Well, honestly, this play would not still be produced if that had he had stuck with that.
So in your book, Nora struggles with the consequences of losing her children as a result of leaving the marriage, but she doesn't consider returning to her husband. Listeners may be thinking, I'd never give up my children, no matter what, you know, how awful my marriage was. How did your experience as a divorced mother influence how you wrote your character of Nora? And we talked about this. You kind of could relate to how hard that was for her to leave her children. And I'm sure you get to people, how could she leave her children? Right? People would say, I would do anything to stay with my children.
Well, I think that's true from a 20th or even 21st century perspective. I do think in the 19th century, women of her class, while she was very fond of her children, she plays with them, but she doesn't take care of them a lot. She does a little bit, probably. I let her, you know, help with the children's dinner hour and putting them to bed. But she has a nurse, a full-time nurse, who lives with her. It's, in fact, the nurse who raised her. Nora herself is a motherless child. Her mother dies in childbirth. So it doesn't seem, I think, that radical to her to leave. She thinks of it as leaving the children in the care of this wonderful nurse who raised her. So
they'll be okay.
And they have a father who will provide for them. But in our 21st century world, that's much harder. One thing I wanted to do is give Nora another child that she would actually have to care for and see if she has a different relationship with that child.
What do you want to say about that relationship?
It's very tender. Mm-hmm. She's a really good mother. And in fact, when she sort of offers to take charge of this little boy, she says, well, I've had three children. She doesn't point out that she really, she also had a nurse, but she does feel confident. You know, she knows how to feed a baby with one of those milk flasks. They're ceramic, so they look really crazy. You had to control them with your thumb in an odd way. But she knows how to do it. She knows how to change a diaper. So, you know, she steps into the role.
How does that impact her thoughts about the children she left behind?
It makes her realize that if she had cared for her own children, she might not have been able to go.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation this morning, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking with Wendy Swallow. Her new book is Searching for Nora, a novel after The Doll's House. So after the turn of the 19th century, how common was divorce, and what would typically happen to the children of divorced parents as we, you know, get into the new century?
Well, during Nora's day, divorce was technically sort of impossible. I mean, she could petition the king for a divorce, but apparently he only handed out a handful of those for a few years. She doesn't even really know that when she leaves. She assumes her husband will divorce her once she goes, which turns out to have been a, you know, kind of crazy assumption because we don't really know what Torvald's going to do. But as we get closer to Solvi's day in the, you know, 1919, 1920, I'm not really sure quite where divorce law is in Norway at that time. Solvi's young. She's not married. She's not thinking about divorce. But it takes a while for divorce law to evolve in all these countries. Of course, by the time Solvi comes along, women have the vote in Norway. So, but she says at one point, you know, I would vote, but I'm not sure my mother will, you know, even though she has a vote.
So you mentioned when you divorced, you shared custody with your two young sons with your ex-husband. Was the concept of co-parenting a relatively new concept when you were going through that, or was it pretty common?
Well, it was becoming more common. But the reason I wrote my first book, Breaking Apart, which is a memoir of my remarriage and my effort to work out good co-parenting with my ex-husband, was because most of the stories you heard about co-parenting were the bad ones. Mm-hmm. And I realized, because I had some friends in our neighborhood that had gone through it, that the story of people who had worked out how to successfully co-parent really wasn't being told. You know, the ones that work are quiet, and of course the ones that don't work get all the attention. So many people had a lot of, of course, when you get divorced, it's like being pregnant. Everyone starts advising you.
Yeah, of course.
And I was struck by how much of the divorce advice out there in the social atmosphere was not current. It did not, had not, you know, in, did not reflect the change in the law. Mothers did not necessarily get custody in Washington, D.C., where I lived. They didn't have an extra, you know, leg up in the game. So it was very much a sort of equal scenario legally. So the things that people would tell me to do, like, oh, take everything and run, that was, one, not really possible under the law, and two, I also felt that divorce was always seen in this very high conflict sort of way. And what I wanted to do was enable my ex-husband to have a good life, too. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to deprive of the boys. He was he turned to me one day and he goes, I want to take care of them. I want to make their little lunches. And I thought, OK, you know, that's a good thing. Like, right. I can work with that. So we worked together to try to make sure that we could both be economically solid. In Washington, D.C., that was a little bit of a challenge because it's an expensive city to live in. I was a professor by then. He worked for the federal government. No one was making huge bucks, but there was enough for us to both have a good life. And the children were everything. And we just wanted to arrange things to their best advantage.
You talk about people giving advice. And, you know, I think especially of our generation, maybe it's a little bit different now, but it would be like, parents shouldn't divorce until the children are grown. Did you hear that?
Yes, I heard that. And ironically, when my second husband, Charlie, and I were planning to marry, we had four teenage boys between us. And one therapist we went to said, well, why don't you just wait until they're all out of college? But one of them was in seventh grade. I said, that's a long time. And, you know, I think they'll be okay. You know, we're going to work really hard to make this work for them. Yeah. So,
And really, the conventional wisdom about divorce has really changed since then.
Yes, yeah, it has.
And I guess because we have these good examples that we can see it's not always gloom and doom.
Well, there are there are a lot of things you can do to make it better for your children. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good research out there, which my divorce memoir got into the research. And in fact, mm-hmm. my remarriage memoir also got into the research. It is tricky to remarry. Something mm-hmm. like 75% of second marriages that include children still living at home do not make it. So mm-hmm. that's like only 25%.
A
lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And I was determined to figure out what are the factors that will make it work for us.
Yeah. And teenagers, too.
And teenagers.
They're a challenge in themselves, right? And then blend families.
I will say having all one gender was easier probably. And boys, you know, if you just feed them enough and have clear rules about who gets to hold the remote, then you're okay.
Yeah. We're talking with Wendy Swallow. Her book is Searching for Nora, a novel after The Doll's House. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Wendy Swallow, who has written a sequel to Henrik Ibsen's play, A Doll's House. It's called Searching for Nora, a novel after The Doll's House. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have some thoughts or comments you'd like to share with us. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's talk about judgment for a minute here. Now, here we have Nora in Ibsen's play, who walks out at the end, leaving her three children, her husband. Of course, no power, as you said. She would have no chance of being able to support or have custody of these children. And certainly times have changed a bit. You can see there would be some judgment on poor Nora here, who really doesn't have a lot of choices in this terrible marriage. But it seems like, sometimes women can do no right. You know, some people are critical of women who have small children who work. Others are critical of women who put their careers on hold to raise their children. So as gender becomes more fluid, do you foresee our society will be less judgmental about choices parents make when it comes to career? Not a choice Nora had.
Boy, that's a very interesting question. I hope so, because everyone is different and everyone's marriage is different. One thing I've learned over the years. And in fact, most people who are not in that, anyone who's not in the marriage probably doesn't really understand what the marriage is about, what the dynamic is like, and how hard or easy it is to live in that marriage. And I think that's true also with women's fulfillment in terms of raising children and or having careers or both, and the constant juggle to try to have both. Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting is once I got Nora out on the American prairie, where she had no choice but to work all the time, mostly household chores, but she, carries a baby around on her hip a lot. And, honestly, that she probably, wished she had some nice daycare center to leave little Thomas so that she could actually go help in the fields. So I think it's, women have always juggled work and children, I think. I do think what is different today is that many fathers certainly put in more time with their kids, and that's great because it makes the whole house work better, gives the wife a little bit more space to do all that other work she has to do.
And now you've mentioned the fact that you had a professional career, which gave you financial security when your marriage dissolved. It's much harder for women without financial security to leave a relationship. So do you think divorce may be more a privilege for women who have the means? You can think of some of these women who really, in a way, would feel trapped as Nora did, as in they don't have a lot of options.
I think that's true. I mean, when I was leaving my first husband, I was very aware that I had a good job. I not only had a good job, I had a lot of emotional support at the job because people thought highly of me and my work, and I felt valued there. Didn't feel particularly valued in my marriage, so that was a nice counterweight. And it certainly gave me the economic means to divorce. Because I divorced during custody terms, I did not really get any alimony, and I got very little child support. It was more equalization, mm-hmm. Which was fair, certainly. I was earning enough to mostly support the boys, but it also changes the dynamic. So women who don't work get more financial support, usually from their husband. But I do think that's true. And the research shows that women really lose, even women who have jobs, often take a huge financial hit through divorce. Mm. And when I was divorced and living in Montgomery County, Maryland, which I sometimes laughingly called the land of divorce because almost everyone I met was or had been, I knew many friends who, women friends who'd had to either move back with their parents, with their kids, or were living in very sketchy neighborhoods, you know, and also if they end up with full custody, they have full care of the children. And it's hard to take care of your children nonstop without, you know, another hand there to help in case of an emergency or something.
Yeah.
So,
and then you can get a job and still not afford, you can't afford the daycare, right?
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
We talked a few minutes ago about, Ibsen in his day being very aware of how you, as a woman, how you marry really determines your future. And we are in this day and age seeing more and more people choosing not to marry, to be parents, but not to marry. So beyond the legal implications, do you think we're seeing sort of this, I don't want to say demise of marriage, but marriage becoming, you know, less important? I mean, I can think of my grandmother always concerned about who I would marry, that kind of that generational thinking about how and who you marry and how that's going to change your set the dynamic of where your life goes.
I think we are getting to a place like that. Well, one of my closest friends during the time I was raising the boys was a friend of mine who had had a child out of wedlock. And except for the fact that she had never married the father of her child, we had pretty much the same circumstances. Mm-hmm. So it didn't really seem to have made a big difference. Her son's father was in his life, and she made room for that. And I will say that when I, the day after I married Charlie, and I had been a single mother for 10 years, my father turned to me and said, "Thank God you're married again." And I was actually offended. I said, "Dad, I own my own house. I had my career. I was taking care of the boys. I didn't need to marry." And he goes, yeah. But, you know, thank God you're married again.
Do you think men struggle the same way women do when it comes to maintaining their identity in a relationship or when they become parents? Do you think men and women struggle differently there?
Boy, that's an interesting question. I will say that when I was a single mother and dating a few people, I had almost no interest in someone who didn't have children. They were different. The ones who had children got it.
A different understanding.
A different understanding. I wanted a man who understood what it was like to struggle with a child who wanted to buy Cocoa Puffs, for example, because every now and then one of my kids would like throw one of those, and I needed someone who just kind of understood that this was not my failure. This was just Cocoa Puffs were way too enchanting. So it really is different, I think. So I do think parenthood changes everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with you. I think so. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking with Wendy Swallow. Her book is Searching for Nora, a novel after The Doll's House. In your novel, you use the character of Solvi, as you mentioned, who comes of age at the end of World War I, to show the progress made by women since Nora's day. Modern day women continue to make progress toward equality with men, but we're not quite there yet. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to see that in this Me Too era, we're also experiencing a backlash against feminism. Why do you think that is?
I think feminism is really ultimately about women having as much power as men have. And the reason Doll's House is still playing in theaters around the world is because women still recognize themselves in Nora, and they recognize their flaws, and they recognize her traps, the things that she's caught in, and that is why this play is still relevant. Mm. And even though the law, even though the law is more on our side now, I would say that in many workplaces and even in some marriages, women are still fighting every day for the right to sort of stand up, show what they can do, not have to hide their power or capability or intelligence to get along in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And Most women I talk to have had those experiences, and that is why Nora still resonates today.
Yeah. We mentioned judgment a little while ago, and in many cases, I think for judgment against women is probably even greater women on women, right? I mean, women have a tendency to judge other women maybe a little more harshly sometimes than men do.
I think that does happen, definitely. I think that's because the choices before women are, I feel, somewhat more fraught. Like, I would have a hard... I remember once leaving my office at the university when I was teaching at American University at 5:30, and one of my male colleagues ran into me in the hall, and he said, "You're leaving now?" I said, "Yes, my children are sitting on a curb. I need to go pick them up." And I realized that, you know, his children were grown, and his wife had taken care of them. And so there were just these little things that...
He never had to think about where the kids were.
He never had to think about where his children were at 5:30 in the afternoon. Yeah. So that's a difference.
Yeah. Let's talk a little about Nora's growth. You talk about, you know, wanting to see Nora become the best person she can be, and you can't just all of a sudden have that happen. Talk about the challenges of writing that and how... You know, what experiences you have to bring into the story to help Nora grow like that. Talk a little bit about that growth and the time frame that you have to do that.
Right. So that was why I wrote a novel, because I felt I needed a lot of range to have her grow organically. And that's a tricky thing. You can't just suddenly have her be different in the next chapter unless quite a bit of time has passed. And then you have to sort of account for that. I really wanted to see her face challenge after challenge. And some of this, I really didn't know how long it would take her. She was a very real character for me, and she still is. She lives in my head all the time. And I would throw things at her and see how she responded. And sometimes I'd have to plan something out so that she could grow over the next couple of chapters. She's going to have to figure this out, this one particular challenge that I'm giving her. And it takes time, and you have to be very deliberate and pace it for her to grow organically in that way. Yeah. And there have to be good reasons for how she changes.
Yeah. One of the things, you know, when we talk to writers of fiction, a lot of times when they're introducing characters or they're writing situations, and they'll say, you know, "I had no idea this character was going to become such a big part of the story."
Yeah.
It's almost like they take on a life of their own.
Right.
You're writing it, but it's almost like something is taking over there. This character keeps coming back, and you aren't expecting it, or you aren't expecting, you say, "I don't know how Nora's going to deal with whatever the challenge is." Did that surprise you, having written nonfiction before that, where you're pretty much writing the facts, right?
And you're writing the facts, but you also shape them, especially in memoir. So memoir is a little bit in its own little hazy land between nonfiction and fiction. All the facts in my memoirs are true. I did find in writing my memoirs that some real people in my life are much better characters than others. And some of my boys feature a little bit more prominently, especially in the second book. And that was interesting. I didn't quite know that was going to happen. You can't have that many people, though, feature prominently in a story. So
get lost, yeah.
Yeah, you need to keep them in balance. And that was tricky when I was writing the Solvi story, which at one point I separated it from the Nora story and just... you know, thought of it as its own novel. So I had to make it strong enough to stand up to balance against the Nora story. And the character Rika, who is Solvi's friend, who's dark, and she had been a nurse during World War I, so she's been through some traumatic stuff, and she's a little wild, and she actually is modeled on a cousin I had who was very much this way. I was the good cousin, she was the bad one, but she was really electrifying to be with, and I had to be careful not to make Rika run away with the story.
Right. Yeah. So what is it you're hoping readers take away from the book, especially since you have sort of the two characters of different generations?
Well, I think the two generations and the times in which they live provide a sort of a full picture of sort of how women are evolving during this period in terms of their legal rights, and then also how they live them personally and publicly. And Nora ultimately gets to a place that is very much about compassion for other women. And I think that ultimately that's sort of the long-term goal here, is that we all, instead of judging each other, I guess, try to understand each other and realize that everyone's story is unique and everyone's experience is unique, and that women are struggling always to sort of make their way in a world that is still complicated mm-hmm. for us. So the two stories together, the Solvi story being a younger story, more hopeful story, Nora's story is a difficult story in some places, mm-hmm. Although her spirit, her heart, and her will and her inventiveness is what really drives her forward.
Did you find it difficult when you're talking about these different generations and, you know, Nora, who you can relate to on a level as a mother, as, a separated family, mm-hmm. How we as women grow as a certain age, you know, mm-hmm. you get a little more reflective and you know, you can identify with Nora. And then you've got Solvi, who's younger, of a different generation and has a different set of circumstances. Did you find that difficult in the writing, or did that come to you? It would seem it would be much easier to write about Nora than it would be to write about Solvi.
Well, actually, it was easier to write about Solvi because she's so much closer to me, mm-hmm. you know, in time.
I got
and
mm-hmm.
I put her in time. I placed her in time so that she was exactly the age as my grandmother, and I know some of the stories of my grandmother. As a young woman, she was quite adventurous and did certain things, and I wanted to capture some of her spirit in Solvi's character, and that was a way of doing it because then I didn't have to imagine what she could get away with at that time. Yeah. I could just think about my own grandmother. But Nora is a little obscured by the mists of time. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's challenging to write about a character who's very 19th century. Yeah. She doesn't talk the way we talk. I mean, one of the real challenges was to try to, when I was writing the Nora story, was to remember it's a pre-Freudian era. So there are certain words and concepts she doesn't have in her head.
Right.
So that was, I had to go through and make sure the language, I didn't use terms like obsession, which certainly existed back then, but it wasn't used in the way it's used today. So that was a little trickier.
Yeah. Do you find that when readers talk to you after they've read the book, they're surprised at all of the history?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. And I've been giving talks to Norwegian descendant groups, the Sons of Norway and the Daughters of Norway. They love their history. And yet many of them, even though they're very well-read people and very well-educated, they're like, wow, we didn't know that, or we didn't know this piece. And so I love, you know, detail that brings the history alive. And that was a lot of fun to kind of get in there and know a lot so that I could then pick out the pieces that would really bring the story to life.
I love the fact that you talked about your grandmother, setting it in her. My grandmother was born in 1901, and I can remember some of the stories. And as a young one, being so surprised, you know, that she would be criticized for riding a bicycle with slacks on, you know, like that.
Oh, yeah.
Like wearing slacks in the 1920s. What? I'm riding a bicycle? And
right, exactly.
And thinking, and it really explained why she was such an activist for women's rights, you know, which we as young women maybe didn't quite understand. That's why I asked that question about if you know, women reading that are going, wait, what? They did what?
Right. Yeah, yeah. And one of the interesting challenges I posed for Nora and somewhat for Solvi is, if you care about women's rights and you care about women, do you take that publicly or do you just fight your fight in your private realm? And that's a question that comes up in this book. Because one of the figures in this book is a true historic figure in Norway, Asta Hanstein, who was really the first Norwegian feminist and the first woman to speak in public. And she's quite an interesting character. And she encounters Nora at one point and asks her, you know, do you want to be public?
Yeah. All right. Wendy Swallow will discuss her novel, Searching for Nora, a novel after The Doll's House. That's Saturday, December 14th at the Snow Library in Orleans. And we'll post a link with more information about the book and the event at our website, capeandislands.org. Wendy, thanks so much for coming in. Such an interesting topic. Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, thank you. It was a lot of fun to have this conversation.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.